This is episode 101 of the Frillo Bros Tech Podcast, thinking outside the incipient chip.
Welcome to episode 101 of the Frillo Bros Tech Podcast. Today is September the 1st, 2013. I'm Matthew Dean Frillo, and this is my laboring brother, James Frillo.
Is it just me, or did that song sound really loud?
It was loud to you?
Yeah.
I couldn't hear it. I had to turn my volume
really?
All the way up, yeah.
My speakers were crackling.
Weird.
Dude, well, I'll tell you what it actually sounds like in... later.
And I say that's why there was that long awkward pause when the song ended, because I was like, was the song ending or is it just too quiet for me to hear?
No, you were good. The song wasn't done yet when you came in.
Really? Oh, nice.
Yeah. No. So I whatever. It's weird.
Cool.
Okay.
Anyways, Labor Day weekend.
Oh, hi. I'm here.
Yeah. You doing anything cool? For the Rose Tech Podcast.
Yes, but they're a secret, so I can't talk about it. What? Right. Well, I don't see her anywhere, but we'll be doing something fun tomorrow.
I'm reading between the lines of context. Okay.
Excellent.
Nice. Okay. Well.
Oh, by the way, I made my first watch face this week. It's really simple because I'm not an expert programmer. Essentially, I added a background to an easy-to-do watch, which is a picture of my dog.
Nice.
His head. So,
black and white.
Black and white, you know, stippled, I think is the right art term there. A bunch of dots.
Right.
But, it's kind of fun to make watch faces.
That is cool. Have you downloaded any cool third-party ones that anybody else has made?
Yeah, I've got a bunch of them. Well, not a bunch. I've got a few of them. I use a timer a whole bunch. Find that very useful. You know, you just gotta make sure you don't flip to another screen because then you lose it. I have a calendar actually where it shows all 30 days.
Yeah.
A month view. There we go. That's also super helpful, I find. I still got that Tetris app too.
Nice.
Cool. So, yeah.
I like it.
How about you? You got any fun plans for the day of labor?
You know, not really. All of my friends and family are out of town and working.
Doing other stuff.
Yeah. I'm like.
Yeah, I was kind of shocked to find out that you weren't headed on that Las Vegas trip.
Yeah, you know, it had crossed my mind, but actually, the big Las Vegas trip that some of our family went on was Chicas only, so that was the major hang-up. Some of our friends, our family went to Canada, others just went down to Monterey. But, yeah, I didn't really know if I was going to have Monday off or not, so I didn't really make any plans, figuring I could just hang out with people that were here, and turns out there are none. What I'm really hoping to do is I'd really like to go on some sort of a hike tomorrow.
Ooh,
but we'll see if I can swing that.
I cannot confirm nor deny that tomorrow will involve walking for me.
Nice. Maybe that's nice. I can't really tell. But anyways, well, this week, since we are laboring tonight, this is the hardest work we'll do all week. This week, we'll be talking, like every week, about technology and the continuing corporate opera, or the soap opera of corporations' dealings backwards and forwards, back and forth.
Backwards and forwards.
The people working
ups
for
and
them.
Downs.
I know, man. I am having a hard
ins
time.
Ins and outs.
The marketing campaigns of such said companies and the technology they're developing. Before we get into the heart of the show, though, James has a short disclosure that he wants to throw at y'all.
Yes, I work for HP. However, I do not represent HP or any of HP's opinions.
Nice. If you want to get a hold of us throughout the week or just follow us or listen to the interesting things that we do, like when we go to the Scottish Games and take awesome pictures with broadswords or watch log throwing and take videos of that. You want to check all that out.
Did you buy the kilt that you dreamt of?
You know, I'm going to. I just haven't yet.
Are you waiting to hit that special number that you're looking for?
You know, that did cross my mind because one of the things. So if you watch the video podcast of this show and you've been watching over the last 2 years, you might have noticed my face getting somewhat slimmer over the course of the last year and a half, mm-hmm. as I've lost over 120 pounds.
So you had a high of 324
and a half.
324 and a half.
Yeah.
Okay. Nice.
Yeah, so pretty crazy. So I'm coming in almost under 190, almost into the wonderland, as fat people like to call it.
Ah, yes. There, almost.
But the thing is with it is that, yeah, so I still probably have another 20-ish pounds to go after that, maybe more. It's hard to tell with my body type. It might be less, might be more, I don't know. But yeah, there is a particular figure that I will have, that I know I will have when I get down to the right weight, mm-hmm. and I think I want the kilt, since it's kind of an expensive purchase, especially if you do it right.
Really? For a skirt? Like,
skirts aren't expensive.
Oh.
Kilts are, though.
What makes them so expensive?
They're usually custom fit. They're actually like, well, it's the part of it is the material. The material's like is tweed from Scotland usually, if you get like a legit one. You can get cheap ones for like $30.
Sure.
Yeah, you can get one for cheap ones, but everyone just like mocks you. And then like the pleating is actually like custom done and stuff to fit your body. So I mean, they're kind of a big deal. They're actually like, you know, you can easily spend $200 or $300 on them. I won't, but you easily can. And
like a nice pair of jeans.
Yeah, wow. Exactly. Actually, yeah, that's a really great analogy. And then they like, there are guys that make custom ones that are like tux fabric, cost like $500, so you can have like a full on tux kilt. It's ridiculous. It's so awesome. I want one so bad I can't stand it.
Gotcha. That'd be a good reward.
Exactly.
Among many others, but yes.
It's actually I mean, that's kind of how I was looking at it. So anyways,
so just had, no. So one more before we move on to the tech stuff.
Okay.
Cause obviously losing that much weight in that amount of time is a significant accomplishment already. What, you know, if someone were interested in that, like, what would you say they do to get started? Like, what was your, you know, what have you found to work, which I'm sure it's a myriad of like a whole bunch of things, but you know, if you could distill it down to something that maybe surprised you about the process, or that you found helpful throughout the process, just on the spot.
I think the root of my problem was a mental health problem,
mm.
and fixing that allowed this show to happen and my weight loss and my current career.
Well, it's funny. I've found I'm doing a bunch of personal finance research. A lot of the people's reasons for their situations that they get in are, in a lot of ways, psychological as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's not necessarily they don't know how to do math, though that is a highly correlated with personal finances. A lot of it is just there's this other stuff that.
I have a wealth of knowledge and that I've gained, and I've got all sorts of advice and stuff. I mean, it's pretty simple. You know, move a lot more, and when you move a lot more, you tend to eat less, just because you know it stays top of mind. Have goals of how you want to move. I want to be able to do this event, or I want to be able to do this sport. You know, from a practical perspective, but. The real root, and those are all great and really useful, and if you're ready for it, those are great things. You know, that those are the core things to start with. But I think a lot of people, me included, or I shouldn't say a lot of people. I don't really know how many people, but I know this is the case for me, and I know that it's not entirely uncommon that it starts with a, you know, if you're not digging your situation, it's hard to really want to change. Once you want to change and are actually motivated to, then pretty much just moving more will start the process. And then, you know, and then once you got the ball rolling, you just learn more as you go.
Okay. You know. You just chase the ball. I gotcha.
Exactly. So anyways, I don't update that kind of information a lot on my Twitter feed and my other various social media stuff, because it's kind of embarrassing. or was, I should say.
It was. Not anymore. But, not at all.
Exactly. So if you but if you do want to follow that kind of stuff and all the other cool things that we follow throughout the week, I would go, my Twitter handle is at Matthew D. Furlow.
I am at James Furlow, also at jamesfurlow.com.
Nice. And my Instagram, it's just, I think I've been using that most for my updating.
Agreed.
I've made a shift, a distinct shift. My Instagram handle is nextwiggin4. You can also look me up, Matthew Dean Furlow. Either one will lead you to my Instagram.
And if you don't know what Next Wiggin is, wait until November.
Yeah, for the best movie of the year.
For the best movie of the year.
We'll
just leave it really, yeah, really ambiguous. You're like, wait, there's a ton in November.
I know, yeah. So, oh, you guys are really excited about Catching Fire. No, it's going to be a good movie, but it won't be the best of the year.
No, it has to do with space.
Yeah, it is a game. Both have games. Yes. Just, and they're both futuristic sci-fis, so, you know, kind of dystopic.
I mean, I can see how they would get, you know, confused.
Has to do with kids murdering each other, you know? I mean, it's you know, it's just one of those. There are shared themes, you might say, but one is distinctly going to be the best, and the other one will be good. Just saying. Actually, you know what's going to kill me? Catching Fire is going to do so much better in the box office.
Well, yeah, but you know what? But Ender's Game has Harrison Ford, so you already know it's going to be a better movie.
Harrison Ford, Ben Kingsley, oh, it's going to be great. I'm so excited. You gave the name, man.
I'm sorry.
You're doing so well. Anyways, yeah, Ender's Game. So, if you want to check out the rest of, also if you want to go check out our personal profiles and all the other clicks and links that we're going to talk about this week, we link all the articles. We also have the show cuts and the show. Sign up for the podcast. All sorts of cool, awesome.
Check out the store.
Oh, yes, and the store. We got a new store. You want some Furlow Bros swag, you can go there. If you don't win our contest, yes, we had a contest last week. We'll be announcing the winners next week, correct?
We will contact the winners.
But if you can't wait, don't worry about it. If you go and buy a bunch of swag, just let us know. We'll get you something else. We let you choose, right?
Yeah, we let you choose.
Yeah, so
no, it's
for
good.
It.
I get notifications of sales, so
okay.
Well, no, we know these things.
What we're saying is,
which P.S. by the way, my shirt is in the mail. It's in Portland.
Man, oh man, I gotta get my beer mug coming. I don't really drink much beer anymore though. I drink enough. I drink enough to
milk in it.
Exactly. Water.
Which we've switched over to almond milk. And then let's just say that there is a transition period of getting used to it, which I am still in.
You'll never get used to it.
Well,
it's not. I mean, you might learn how to swallow it, but you'll never get used to it.
I'm just saying.
Dude, just remember. You remember when I was allergic to milk and like?
Dude, I remember that.
Like half a decade of it. To this day, I still get the taste of all your artificial milks in my mouth just thinking about it. So gross, man. Nasty. I'm not even like somebody who loves milk, like, but it's there's nothing like a glass of milk. So yeah. Anyways, man.
So
FurlowBros.com. That's where all the cool stuff is.
As yeah.
Further and further distracted.
Yep. So I'm gonna start it off with a fun one, maybe. It's okay. The Dirty Little Secrets.
I want to hear this, man.
Yeah, so Reddit had a thread, is that what they call them?
Yes.
It said, what's a dirty little secret, or big secret, about an industry that you've worked in that people outside the industry really ought to know? That's good to know. So here's one of them. Here's from your favorite, Kickstarter. You know those celebrity endorsements on Kickstarter videos?
Mm-hmm.
They're paid for.
Of course.
Yep. One of the big ones charges $10,000 per video.
Whoa.
Yeah, pretty crazy. So yet in a video he released about his own game, he filmed it in a scruffy-looking kitchen as if trying to play down the vast fortune he has amassed. And then kind of on top of that it goes, most game Kickstarters can afford their projects or get funding from elsewhere, and most are actually. Kickstarter is used just to get extra money and to gauge interest in projects.
Which I don't understand why that bothers people. I feel like that was obvious to anybody who like half paid attention to Kickstarter, that that's 90% of what those projects are, you know, I can, it's a great idea, especially the tech stuff. Those are these huge, vast technological projects with tons of work necessary, and they're raising tons of money. If you can get that much interest, I guarantee there's a VC out there that's already interested and it's going to throw money behind it. But they're just saying, hey, look, if you could do 50% this way, get some sales out the door. Like, okay. That bugs me that was a surprise to anybody.
So, here's one. This person, he works for a fiber internet to the home company.
Comcast.
He goes, we offer 50 gigabits a second and the fastest at 150 gigabits. In reality, the company tested a fiber check bandwidth and couldn't actually calculate the speed as the machines weren't powerful enough. So he said it was something like 40 terabits a second before the machines topped out. So he's like, so essentially we actually don't know how fast our fiber really is. We just say it's fast.
Well,
which I guess that's a good problem to have.
Yeah, that's interesting.
There were some other interesting ones. Okay, I thought this one was interesting. This person, he worked at a patent firm in college. Patent offices will patent anything. They will find a way, no matter what, to do so. They will also lie and pretend to be very excited about your amazing idea. He goes, trust me, I've worked on some of the most ridiculous patents and smiled all the way through the process. Do not get false confidence from your patent lawyer. They don't care how good or bad your idea is.
Once again, I feel bad because I know people who come up with cool ideas, and you know I've fallen victim to this before. And you're just looking for any validation, trying to find somebody who thinks it's a cool idea, and then you find a lawyer who's going to profit mightily off of your idea, no matter what, because they're going to make their money from filing papers before you make any money. You're going to pay them no matter what. So, of course, they're going to give you that validation that you want, no matter how ridiculous. That's one of those ones that's just upsetting because it's lawyers being lawyers, you know, just bloodthirsty sharks, man. Ugh. No offense to the lawyers in our audience. If you're a lawyer, I'll bet you're awesome, and you would never take advantage of anybody. But...
So you'll get a kick out of this one, I think.
All right.
It's a little long, so just kind of bear with me here. I used to work for an Apple store in New York, then one in New England. We help people launder drug money into iPhones. It happens all day, all the time. Thugs come in with tens or sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash or Visa gift cards. Technically, we're supposed to report any cash payment of $10,000 or more to the IRS. But managers always arrange it so each transaction is only about $9,999 and then say that, in quotes, we can't keep track of who has paid us what. We were told that the laws are, quote, impossible to enforce, and it's not our place to stop it from happening. They turn the drug money into iPhones and ship the phones back to their country for sale, since iPhones can be exchanged for cash just about anywhere. Many of them carry concealed firearms in our store. If people are wondering why Apple stores have such a short stock of iPhones even months after launch, it's usually because these people buy them all and cart them out into unmarked vans. August is the month of tax-free holidays in New England stores, and if you don't believe me, check into your local store on days when there's no sales tax. We stocked the warehouses with thousands of iPhones specifically for these guys. Apple stores intentionally refuse to comply with money laundering laws and intentionally assist criminals in hiding drug profits.
Well,
boom!
That's, once again...
Dirty little secret.
That is so classic Reddit. that the Apple store one. Oh, obviously Apple's the big evil kings of this one, because you know that doesn't happen in Best Buy's and your Fry's Electronics and Costco. Like, it happens everywhere with TVs and anybody with a good return policy, that happens. I guarantee it. On high-end tech, that is so, you know, I'll bet the companies that actually intentionally try to avoid that are way more rare than the companies that that do everything they can to make sure they have enough in stock to support the laundering that goes on. You know, there's a certain part of me that's like, you know, I'd like to think that I'm an upstanding citizen enough where if I thought that there was something truly immoral going on there that I would prevent it from happening, but that's an awful lot of money. And, you know, I'm sure that it's Apple. I'm like, I'll bet there's a lot of managers that are like, dude, it's drug money. Like, it should be legalized and taxed anyways. Like, what am I doing here by stopping this? You're stopping violence in the streets from gang members. That's what you're stopping, Apple.
Oh, gee.
You know, grow a moral compass. No. But I mean, honestly, I can see why that happens, I feel like that's a much bigger deal on Reddit because it's like, oh, look at Apple being the bad guys. Ooh, you know, whereas I think if it came out that Best Buy did it, everybody would be like, okay, congrats,
yeah,
Best Buy.
One of the perks of being top dog. And exactly. Then there was one more.
Okay.
Massive shocker here. Okay?
Yeah.
Olive Garden's delicious warm breadsticks aren't actually unlimited.
You know, there's an entire subreddit about Olive Garden and their unlimited soup and salad and breadsticks. That's funny. I wonder what the world is a lie. That's the last line of the article.
I haven't hit the limit. Yeah.
Well, I wonder what their limit is. You know, it's
you could probably ask. I always wonder too, like, if I just, like, just keep it coming. I know I got some on the table, but I don't want those anymore. Oh, then when you get done, can I have a to-go box?
You see, that's the one that always gets me, is that they let you take breadsticks to go. And I'm always like, really? I could see saying unlimited breadsticks while you're sitting here. Maybe, you know, it's funny, they might have a policy where it's like a certain portion of their overall supply. You know, it's like, we need enough, you know, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we need enough breadsticks left to make it through the rest of the night, so you're cut off. The average table eats 10 breadsticks. We're going to have an average of, you know, 13 more tables, so sorry. That's We've fine. Only got 132 left. I wonder. That's interesting.
Yeah. That would be worth experimenting with a group of friends.
Would it be? You'd have to eat at Olive Garden.
I like Olive Garden.
That was rough. I'm sorry. That was an unfair buy. Because I have a feeling that a lot of our audience just did what you did. I like Olive Garden.
Yeah,
what's wrong with Olive Garden? And I'm just.
So I did have my friend. He was talking to me, and he goes, "Man, I went to an Olive Garden recently. It's not the same place it used to be." It's like, really? Okay.
Well, the thing is that Olive Garden is part of like a giant consortium of Italian themed restaurants. There's like three major chains that they're part of. There's like Maggiano's at the super high end, the Macaroni Grill in the middle, and then I believe it's these three, and then Olive Garden at the bottom. And they all get stuff from like the same factories. They're all the same parent company and everything. So they're all like very closely related. But your Olive Garden's like your cheap version. You know, Maggiano's is like your super swanky nice version. But the thing is, like, a decent good meal at Maggiano's costs like $2-3 more per meal, like, than Olive Garden, but the quality of service and everything is off the charts better. I mean,
it's
totally worth the extra 10-20% that you pay, in my humble opinion. But I don't eat that much pasta, so.
I understand. I want to learn how to make my own pasta.
You know what? That's the best way to do it, man. And honestly, it's, you know, honestly, healthiest and most delicious. That's what I'm saying.
Of course, I also want to learn how to make fresh mozzarella, which from what I understand is not super easy, but
worth it. That's what it is.
I'll get there. So anyways, that's my even that was semi-tech. We'll get in. We got some good ones. Don't worry.
All right. So Pandora has announced as of this morning that there's no longer a 40-hour weekly limit on your music listening, which is kind of exciting.
So why would you ever upgrade?
Because they don't want you to commercials. They dramatically increased the number of commercials and the pacing of commercials.
Really?
Yeah. So it's like
possible.
I know. Well, they're getting even more aggressive, but it's how they're kind of trying to get you to upgrade. But the big thing is, and I'll tell you what this is, man. iTunes. is not going to put a weekly limit on how much music you can listen to.
That's right. I keep forgetting about that.
I'm going to say, man, I actually think what that was is they don't want you to... Because now you're going to have, like, every computer has... Almost every computer has iTunes on it. And what you're going to do is come September, you know, 11th, all of a sudden everybody's going to have a solid competitor. You get to the end of your 40 hours, you haven't upgraded yet, and all you're going to do is you can flip over to iTunes and never flip back. And I think that's what they're afraid of.
Or they want to take one talking point away from Apple.
Right, yeah. So that's all that is.
Apple from saying it, but...
Right, yeah, they were like other competitors.
Not us.
Yeah, so there, you know what's going on, though. There's some other internet radio out there. It's some, like, tiny little group. They've got, like, license for 20 songs, and they do still have a limit on it. They're like a nothing. And Apple will just put some of our competitors... have a limit, and they'll talk about Pandora before it and after that, but not actually say Pandora during that period, which is how they, I mean, that's, it's so funny. It was like iTunes, when iTunes first launched, dude, that story about, a bunch of independent artists, at first they were only going through big record labels, right? Or when they first launched, they said, we're going to have all this music. But they wanted to do a similar model to what they do with the iBookstore, where they only work with major publishers. Because Apple only works with like 8 publishers, or it's more than that, but you have to have hit a certain critical mass. Well, if you're an independent publisher or you're self-publishing, how do you get on the iBookstore? Well, there are these publishers that are basically just they are negotiating groups that you submit your works to, and they negotiate with Apple for everybody that they represent, which is all of your self-publishers. Well, that's how Apple wanted to go about iTunes when it first launched. There were a couple of people, but this one guy in particular realized this was going on and was like, awesome. He talked to Apple. They told him kind of what was going to be going on, and so he went out and he started signing contracts with all of these independent artists, going through every, you know, just getting tons and tons and tons and tons of people, and in anticipation for the launch, because once the launch happens, he signs his contract, he takes a small cut, and it was going to work out great, and he was all ready to go. and then Steve Jobs came on stage and said, unlike some of our competitors who are going to, you know, are only working with small labels and independent artists, and listed him as a specific competitor, like, we're only dealing with major record labels and major artists. And he was just like, what just happened to me while he was watching the keynote. He was like, it was like a freight train. I was like, how did that just happen? How did that just happen? And so he was like, he is not an Apple fan, specifically not a Steve Jobs fan anymore. But that's the sort of thing that Apple will do. I'll bet they'll get in a couple of Pandora jabs.
Good for it.
Yeah.
They're good for it. Okay, cool. 40 hours.
Yeah.
Limit no more. I like it. I like it. I think you're still up, unless you don't want to be.
No, I'll go with another one. So the new iPhone, as we've already heard, what do we know about it? It's going to be faster. It's going to be the same size. It's going to be golden.
Golden.
But the name that everybody's been throwing around is not a gold iPhone, but a champagne-colored iPhone.
Ah, yes. Even one of our shirts, that's what we call it, champagne-colored.
Exactly. And it's funny, man. The moment I read this, like, a bunch of alarms went off in my head, and I wish I had said something because it would have made me look like a prophet again. But now I'm just coming up. I'm coming up too late because... like, if you know anything about your sparkling wines, obviously, like, the signature of champagne is that it's a sparkling white wine.
Right.
And a lot of times people will be like, you know, let's go get some champagne. And they'll go out and buy Andre's style, you know, champagne, which is one of your, you know, less expensive but still totally tasty champagne, you know, sparkling wines out there. But technically, it's not a champagne because in order to be a champagne, you have to come from the Champagne Valley of France,
yes,
and be a sparkling wine. And they are vicious about that title because to keep the name Champagne is where that valley, that group, gets all of their, like, that's what gives them, you know, it allows them to charge a premium, a ridiculous premium,
yeah,
on wine that's just as good as your, like, $5 bottle of sparkling wine, you know, and then they, like, have honestly better, you know, champagnes that are equal to your $10 bottles of champagnes, but they start at $30 and go up to $150. I mean, it's crazy because they come from that specific valley, even though they're not necessarily better, but it's all about the name.
Yeah,
And so they defend it like, oh man, they're lions, dude. They're crazy about it. And
tigers are.
Yeah, you know, it's like,
I think it's like Katie,
Katie, yeah, that's right. You're gonna be like bears. But it's,
that's not from Troy.
Yeah, that's not. There's this, you know what it is? It's
from that 40 inspirational.
Yeah, 40, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's right after the, we are lions. You gotta be like a bear, man.
I knew exactly what you were talking about.
That's awesome. If you've never heard that before and you're listening, look up 40 inspirational quotes in 2 minutes. It's one of the greatest short videos I've ever seen. And it's
yeah,
like,
the new term for those is a supercut.
Oh, is that what it is?
That word didn't exist until, in my opinion, until like a year ago.
Yeah.
Now, I think thanks to YouTube, that is now the word. A supercut is when you do multiple cuts from multiple movies.
Right. Okay.
That's a new word. That's your word for the day, which I like. Yeah, I didn't put that together until, well, for me it was only like a month ago. But
interesting. I'll have to pay attention to that. But anyway, so back to champagne. So Apple, who's like a constant target for anything they do, it's like the stupid clock face on their phone. It's like, it's one of the most iconic clocks in the world, but it's technically owned by somebody else. So as soon as Apple uses it, anybody else can use it on the internet. Nobody will say it because it's, you know, because it's like, you know, it's super iconic and nobody else is making money off of it. But all of a sudden they realize this is Apple and we think we can get some money. So they went after them. Well, the specific lawyer group that's actually in charge of making sure that nobody uses the term champagne when they're not supposed to, has flipped out, and they've already preemptively come guns blazing at Apple, being like, don't you dare call it champagne. Don't you dare, which I really hope they do, because of the drama of it.
I wonder, I saw this or a similar article, and my initial thought was just like, what idiots, you know? It's not as if Apple's a shoddy brand. It's not as if it's even a drink.
Right.
You know, I understand that they were able to go after Pierre, but, you know, that's a drink. It's sparkling water, as a matter of fact.
Right.
Come on. I mean, that's pretty close. I get that. But, I mean, we're talking about a phone.
Well, and not to mention the fact
which probably has a champagne app or two on it.
Right.
And I just, there's a part of me that's like, here you have an opportunity to, you know, to in some ways to partner with, we haven't even known if it's coming, but whatever.
It is coming.
You know, to partner with Apple and to, like, at least get some money from it, right? Hey, we're interested in trademarking the name or whatever, it's leasing the color, which I'm like, okay, I get it. You got the word champagne. But has it ever been used as a color anywhere?
It's constantly used, and that's their argument. That's what's so funny. They the first line of their rebuff to this imaginary threat is that, like, champagne's not a color. You can't have something be champagne colored. There's no universally accepted color of champagne. And you're like, and which what'll be awesome is if, like, Apple comes out with a Zinfandel-colored, you know, iPhone and some other wine.
You want to do champagne, and
right,
actually, I know why they want to, and this will be part of their argument, right, is it does evoke a sense of elegance
right,
and, you know, and specialness, you know, and And so that's why they would choose as opposed to gold, you know? Yeah. And so I get it. And if anything, they have a case because of that. Hey, you know what?
That's the problem is that, and I actually think I agree completely. That's the problem is that Apple is leveraging their
might.
they're really leveraging their brand, and they know it, and they're doing it in a way that they think that they're saying you're going to try to get away with it by, you know, saying that we're not making a sparkling wine, but what we protect is the brand. We protect it from other sparkling wines first and foremost, but we protect the brand in general. And right now, you are the biggest company in the world that is about to start leveraging our brand. And if we don't step up and say don't now, you know, what happens if all of a sudden Apple completely falls apart in the next 5 years and the iPhones start being the worst phone on the market? You know, that's what their fear is. We don't want to say it's okay now while the phones are still cool. We want to say it's not okay now because we don't want to tether our brand to your brand. And valid, I think.
But I know, and I get it too. Like their policy is just to say no, right?
Right.
They don't, similar to Apple's policy a lot. Right. No, iPhone. Sorry.
Yeah, New York wanted to use an apple as part of their logo because they're the big apple, and Apple sued them. So yeah. It's not like, you know, it's not like Apple's an innocent party in this sort of thing.
Yeah, but I could see it. I could see where Apple just, they do it anyways. You know, yeah. They just be like, you know what, we got enough money in the bank. Sure. Why not?
Yeah.
Let's have fun with this. Because by the time that goes through the systems and through the courts, we'll have sold 100 million of them and it won't matter.
Right, and I could see them paying them.
They get fined for it, and they're like, and they are like, you know, fine, that's part of the cost of getting the name, and we don't care. You know, let the courts,
right.
Like, even if we lose, we still win.
Or if they change the name later on, where it's like, they go for like 6 months of it being called Champagne until it's just planted in everybody's brain, and then like 6 months later, they lose the lawsuit, and they quietly change all of the, you know, they change it to black, white, and gold on the website. You know, and but I don't know. It's interesting. It's funny. It's definitely
get our copper phone.
Yeah. Get our copper colored aluminum phone.
I love the title here. French wine snobs warn Apple. Totally true. Oh yeah. Man, they did. Then they come off as complete snobs.
It's true.
But I do.
So speaking of copper, I'm going to jump right into this one because I think it's interesting.
Okay.
So this is kind of, that's the wrong article. I'll have to find it for us. But
search for that title. You'll find it.
I will. I actually know exactly where to find it. I deleted it. I'm such an idiot. Never mind. I'll start. You Google it. I'll start talking because I remember it. So basically, what happened was graphene is, you know, obviously it's the super material of 2013. Carbon nanotubes were 2011, 2012, but nobody could figure out how to manufacture them, so they're super boring, and everybody decided that they're not fun anymore. Graphene is having a little bit more success in its manufacturability. And which is particularly exciting to me because my company had a brief discussion with the Nobel laureates and that actually are working at a Manchester University, and I might get to design a furnace that gets to help further develop this stuff. But one of the things that's going on is they're looking how to build composites because, you know, graphene in and of itself, if you put enough graphene together, you get graphite, which is what pencil lead's made out of. Yeah, it's not really, in and of itself, you know, a stack of graphene is super lame. But what they want to do is they want to be able to put it together with other stuff and see if they can't make something cool. And so there are all different things going on. They're trying to make transistors. They're trying to make circuitry, blah, 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 blah. But one of the ways that they're trying to use graphene is to leverage its strength because it's got incredible tensile strength. So what they did was they started to build these composite materials where they'd start with a piece of copper. Then they'd deposit a layer of graphene, and then they'd deposit another layer of copper on top of that, and then they'd deposit another layer of graphene, and then another layer of copper, and another layer of graphene, and another layer of copper. And what they do is they do these in, like, they do this with vapor deposition, where you take super high temperatures in a vacuum, and then you excrete just a very small amount of the material, and it gets all over every surface. So you can do, like, nearly molecular thin layers of deposition, and through that process you're able to build up these pretty cool materials that are copper and I think it's copper, aluminum, no, multi-layered alternating layers of graphene and metal. Let's see here, what were the two? Yeah, so the results showed the composite material.
I see the word nickel in there.
There we go. The results showed the composite material's ability to block dislocations and cracks caused by external damage traveling inward to be much greater than that of conventional metal multi-layer materials. So usually when multi-layered materials, you're different alloys and composite materials, when they start to crack, that crack propagates. And so the crack is usually the chink in the armor, as it were. That starts to propagate, and that's where you have a problem. And basically what the graphene does is its tensile strength is so incredible that it prevents you from being able to... The crack from propagating. So even though individual layers may not be very strong, the overall strength of the material becomes incredibly strong. Because with metals, generally their compressive strength is impressive because you don't crack along compressive lines. You crack in tensile when you're pulling it apart, and the graphene prevents the tensile from breaking. The metal holds together during compression, and so now all of a sudden you have this really, really incredibly strong material.
So give me an example of when that might be happening. Is it being pulled or pushed or?
So in this case, they're talking about like building composite materials for, I'm assuming, like weapons and bulletproof armor and tank armor and stuff.
Okay.
That's big, big business, building those sorts of alloys.
Oh, yeah.
So they're, and that's where you'll get real, if you could build
a tank that doesn't get destroyed when hit, that'd be convenient.
Right. Well, and it's funny,
for that matter.
Exactly. The Abram tanks right now, one of their, like, cool tricks that they have is that their alloy metal shells aren't designed to be able to take the impact of an explosive. What they're designed to do is to cause explosives to bounce off of them. And so when they do, like, these super fast... Right, because when they do these, like, super fast, like, filming, you'll watch the rockets come in from the, like, shoot rockets at the Abram tanks from helicopters. You'll watch them hit the armor, deflect off, go off, like, 5 feet, and then detonate. And at that detonation distance, it doesn't damage the tank. If you could get a direct impact of a shell or a missile, you could actually do damage to the tank, but you can't get a direct hit because things just bounce off of them. And that's like, that was what the alloy was designed to do. So yeah, I mean, this sort of stuff, this is where you would use it in, like, you could use it in spacecrafts and different stuff like that.
Body armor.
Exactly. The increase in strength varied depending on the interlunar distance, with 70 nanometers exhibiting 500 times more strength than pure copper, and 100 nanometers measuring to be 180 times stronger than pure nickel. A clear relationship between the interplanar distance and the strength of the material was identified. It was also concluded that smaller interplanar distances made dislocation more difficult, thus resulting in a stronger material. Mm. So I don't know. This is pretty exciting. What they're talking about is in production of automobiles and new spacecraft, lightweight, ultra high strength parts may be possible.
That's cool.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's very cool. And the best part about this sort of stuff is it's all vapor deposition. So what you do is you make your plastic part, and then you send it into these chambers, and you put copper down, and then you put carbon down, then you put copper down, then carbon down, and carbon, you know, and so you can start with your 3D printed part, and then you process on top of that, and then you have these incredibly lightweight, strong, and complex shapes. I mean, this is the sort of stuff where you get into like really additive manufacturing and the future of additive manufacturing, where and the best part about it is it's copper, carbon, and plastic are your three basic materials.
We have a lot of that.
Yeah, exactly. We have an unbelievable amount of that, which is what makes it so exciting, because it's affordable. Now all you're talking about is the tool to actually build it. And a vapor deposition chamber is expensive, but it's not necessarily any expensive than a high-end CNC milling machine.
Oh.
So, you know.
Yeah.
So it's like, this could be big. This could be a big one.
Dude, that's like, how far away do you think we are before this becomes, you know, commercially viable? We start to actually see products
with graphene. Honestly, yeah. Five years. I think in 5 years you'll start to see your first. I mean, they're moving so fast, and they got so much money.
Can you somehow combine it with glass?
Yes. That's the big first step is to build to do graphene layers on glass, because it's transparent at one layer thick, and so you can use it for conductive purposes. It allows you to build way better transistors. The whole goal is to combine graphene.
Glass that doesn't break, but you know,
right. Whatever. Well, the goal is to do your flexible Gorilla Glass, that stuff that they just did. OLED screens using carbon or using graphene as your conductor, because it's all three are flexible and incredibly strong. And if you put the graphene on the whole thing as like your sealing outer layer, you've now given it an incredible amount of puncture and scratch resistance. It's like it's one of those things where you sit there and you go like this. Actually has the potential to make like crazy strong, you know, flexible glass that you can put anywhere, and touchable display glass. You know, I don't know. It's cool. It's definitely, you know, there's something here, and there's a there, and unlike carbon nanotubes, where nobody ever really showed a long strand of a carbon nanotube. Nobody ever got above, like, I think it was like 5 inches was the longest anybody ever did. Nobody showed a foot-long strand. Whereas, like, we build sheets of it. We build, like, giant sheets of it. Now, actually figuring out how to use it in such a way that you get to take advantage of all the strength and everything, that's more challenging. But to build a giant sheet of it is easy, which is really, really exciting. It definitely points in the right direction.
Cool.
So
I like it.
I might
bring on the graphene.
Yeah, and as this might affect me directly financially, I'm really excited about it.
Also a plus. A plus. Thank you for the disclosure there. So let's say you come out with a handheld gaming system that is in 3D.
Yes.
What's the logical next step to take?
To make it 4D.
Yes, you're exactly right. 4D divided by 2.
Okay, that's 2N.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's more like a 2B, isn't it?
Well, it depends on which way you cut it.
Oh, okay.
The top half is an N.
Okay.
Bottom half is a U. That's what I'm saying.
Anyways, I was thinking more like D is the fourth letter in the alphabet, B is second letter in the alphabet.
Yeah, see, now that is pretty clever too. That's the point.
So, Nintendo.
Yeah.
For only $129, you can get a Nintendo 2 DS.
Oh, man.
Which comes after the Nintendo 3DS.
Right. This is sort
makes
of like,
no sense.
This is sort of like Microsoft's trend of having the first Xbox, then the Xbox 360, and then having the Xbox One, which is technically the same name as the first Xbox. But But it's a different product.
But they spelled it out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's different. I'll give them that. It's kind of
like,
different.
It's kind of like Fast and Furious, right? They had like
Too Furious.
Well, no, how did it go? It was like the Fast and Furious.
Oh yeah.
And then they had Fast ampersand Furious.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
It was just totally different. But anyways, So Nintendo is coming out with another console.
Yes, they are.
A handheld. But it's 2D.
It's 2D, it's cheap, and this is the other big thing. It's not bendable. Every Nintendo handheld Game Boy, as it were, that's come out in the last couple of years has been clamshell style, and this is going back a step. It's flat, no clamming, which is an interesting.
So hopefully the screens are resilient.
I believe they are.
So there's that, and I actually don't want to talk too much about it, other than it brings up a great excuse to talk about Nintendo in general.
Okay. Wait, do you want an explanation of why they're doing this, or are you about to do that? Or do you not care?
I don't care too much, and I think what I'm going to talk about is more interesting, but give me the real quick, why are they doing this?
It's for 10-year-olds. It's cheaper, it's less breakable because the clamshell was always the most vulnerable part of the system, and in order to lower the price, they got rid of the 3D screen, which was the most expensive part, but it plays all your 3D games. It's basically for little kids. It's actually kind of a cool direction, and pretty tempting for some of your 27-year-olds. as somebody who has continually wanted to buy a 3DS, but hasn't yet, but of course, the 3D is part of what I think is so awesome. So I don't know. I'm probably just going to continue to refuse to give in to that part of my childhood psyche. But anyways, talk about something more interesting.
Okay. So so John Gruber, who is actually an Apple analyst, he made it looks like a quick tweet. That's what it looks like. He goes, "It's $129. I say they should just give in and start making iOS games. I'm not going to win this battle." To which he got some feedback. And so he spent some time saying, okay, let me dive in just a little bit more to this. And I thought it was very interesting the way he thought about Nintendo's business. He goes, first of all, I'm not saying that Nintendo should get out of hardware. He's saying, I think that they should continue to make hardware and make iOS games. And you know, because he's like, there's a viable business there. Other companies have done it successfully. And he's like, I wouldn't even do a port of an existing game. Doesn't make sense at all. Do a totally new one. Like one of his games, which, you know, I'm going to say it and you'll be like, yeah, please, would be like Mario Kart Touch.
Yeah.
Right? Like, who wouldn't be like, oh, that sounds actually kind of intriguing and awesome.
You know, if it had good handling, it had good controls, I'd pay $30 for it. Especially if it had, like, wireless multiplayer. I would pay $30 for that.
Which was his other point. He goes, you know, a lot of people, seems to be this race to the bottom on iOS apps. But he's like, but honestly, Nintendo can get away with charging $15 or $20 for their apps. He goes, now, people on iOS might be like, whoa, that's a lot more than normal. But he goes, but you know, Nintendo owners be like, whoa, that's an awesome deal.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's not a $35 game. Come on now.
Yeah, exactly. And then he's like, and then when you come out with the next version next year, he goes, you just drop it to $8 or $10. You know, drop it down, enjoy that long tail of sales. You could do it. And his whole thing was like, just come out with two good games from the bottom up. He's like, because you guys are great at making interesting, cool games. Everyone knows it. Everyone says it. We talked about it that last week a lot. He's like, you could do that. And, you know, do games that don't depend on a D-pad, and you save those for your 3DS. And he's like,
I would play the snot out of a Pokemon game. I would pay $50 for an iOS Pokemon game, like a full-blown one.
Dang.
Like, I would pay stupid money for it. Because it's like, that's honestly, when I think about buying the 3DS, like, I think, to me, it's like, what games, I always ask the question, what games would I buy? And I'd sit there and I'd go, well, obviously, you get the Super Marios, but I'd play those for like an hour, like, before I'd get bored. You'd get like some of the classic games like Zelda, which would be fun, and I might get a couple hours out of that. But the only one that I can actually see myself sitting down and like playing for long periods of time are Final Fantasies, and which I've never really played. I'm just assuming I would enjoy it. But specifically Pokemon. I haven't played Pokemon since the stupid yellow version, since the third version of the game, and I still to this day think, man, that'd be a lot of fun. I'd totally do that. You know, and I just sit there and I go, like, there is so much potential there. But this is like, it goes back to if Nintendo were to build like a hardcore Pokemon game, like an adult Pokemon game, you know, with like as a console game, full blown RPG, they'd sell a bazillion copies of them. But for whatever reason, they feel very, you know, they're very, very protective of that brand. They want to keep it what it is, and they make oodles and oodles and oodles and oodles and oodles of money on it, and they don't want to rock the boat on that, so they won't. But I think that's part of their problem and reason why they wouldn't move in the direction of iOS is because the games where it would make most sense, or the franchises where it would make most sense to move them over to iOS, they don't want to rock the boat on.
Well, again, don't necessarily move the franchises. You know, I would be like, you know, try something new. You know, they still come out with interesting, cool games.
It's true.
You know, and just try something totally out of left field. It's like, it's made by Nintendo.
Whatever. Go for some, I'm going to say, and I actually think they would be better off doing $15 on, you know, go for a $15 game on something that's completely new intellectual property. Don't go with a Kid Icarus that, well, we haven't touched this IP in 20 years, but technically it's IP we own. You know, make a new character. Make a character that you would, the next version of Super Smash Bros. Would get to include, because and do something. I think if they were to go that direction, man, they would have some serious potential. And if they were just to arbitrarily say Pokemon and Mario stay on Nintendo platforms, and then we've got other games that we're willing to put on other platforms, I think that'd be hugely beneficial to them, and it would start that trend of, you know, allowing people to move over while protecting the hardware sales of the Nintendo, you know, or heck, you know, move Sonic over, move something that's not like a, even though it's Nintendo IP, it's not traditionally Nintendo IP. I think they, you know.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I think they should do it. Another interesting thing you brought up in this article is, like, you know, let's try to find analogies for what makes sense with these guys. Because he's like, a lot of people give the analogy of Apple, because they make their own hardware and they do all that stuff. To which they're like, he was like, it's okay. You know, and from a cultural standpoint and the way they think about it, yeah, sure, it makes sense. But he goes, but a better comparison than Apple might be Disney. Yeah. And he goes, because both companies at their core are businesses of entertaining, and they have a family-friendly lineup of iconic characters and franchises. Right? And he says, and one thing that has long fascinated him about Walt Disney was that he was always looking for the next big thing and never worried about protecting the last big thing. And in this way, I've always thought Disney mindset and leadership were strikingly similar to those of Steve Jobs, which I would agree. They started by making animated short films and conquered that. With Snow White, they ventured into features at a time when the consensus was that no one wanted to see feature-length animated films. And now they're like, awesome. And now we watch superhero movies, which are just like a combination of animation and real life. And then he says...
Yeah, and don't forget that Disney now owns Marvel, so we're pretty much just watching Disney movies.
Yeah, exactly. And he says, but the key decision was Disney's embrace of television in the 1950s. All other movie studios eschewed television. They saw it as a lesser medium. Tiny screens, tiny sound, fuzzy picture quality. Of course, they also saw it as a threat. But not Walt Disney. He saw television as an opportunity, a way to expand his company's reach. And he goes, and that's the way that Nintendo sees iOS gaming. Right? Yeah. They're like, dude, it's inferior. It's not as good. Even though when you actually start to compare screens, you go, actually, the iPhone and even Android devices are significantly better devices than the DS's, which honestly is why they're not selling. They're just not as good.
The internal hardware and the screen resolution are completely off base, but it's the buttons. They like buttons. Understandably, everybody likes buttons, which almost means that I personally think Nintendo should make the best iPhone controller in the world, you know, and if that's really what they feel is slacking, but they don't want to do that. They don't want to be dependent on Apple. They want to be, you know, they want to be independent. And so they have to go with, and the problem is that, you know, they're not expert hardware guys. That's not what they're, or even if that's probably unfair, and I'm sure if there's any Nintendo engineers listening, they're going to be like screaming their head off, but their expertise is in making affordable hardware that still makes the company money, which results, and that's an incredible challenge that they do very well. They squeezed every pixel and every gigahertz out of that device that they can, and still turn a profit with every device and have it be affordable for, you know, parents to justify to buy for their kids. That is an impressive engineering feat in and of itself, but the problem is it results in hardware that's way inferior to Sony and Microsoft. Samsung and Microsoft and Apple. I mean, it's just, you know, that's a tough one. It's because Apple gets away with it because they don't make affordable devices. They make $800 devices. Yeah. Sony gets away with it by selling PSPs at a loss. You know, Nintendo does a fantastic job building what they build. But the problem is that they've now gotten into this point where the only way to sell them is to have something that nobody else has, a quote gimmick, which, you know, sometimes it turns into a really great new way to control it, like with the Wiimotes, but it, essentially that started as a gimmick. It was something that nobody else was going to do, and so they did it, and it panned out. And then, you know, the 3DS, they thought the same thing, but the problem is that it's as cool as 3D is, it doesn't give you any. It doesn't allow you to do play. It doesn't allow you to make any new games. It's just a different paint job. And I've always thought that there's like, you know, I don't need to upgrade systems in order to get a new paint job. I need to upgrade systems to get better, cooler games.
Well, and their year-over-year sales are down 26% or 23%, mm-hmm. something like that, which indicates that they're, you know, a quarter of the population totally agrees with you. Another one of the, you know, the things that people say is you got to have the D-pad. You can't have good games without the D-pad. But you're like, all right, well, maybe that's the case. You know, and maybe that's the reason to stay away from iPhone. So, like, still, there are some good games out there that are fun with touchscreens. And it says, furthermore, what was the example that he gave? He was like, there are some apps that, or, you know, productivity apps that make sense to have a keyboard, but yet they still sell a bazillion of them and people still use a ton of them.
Yeah.
You know, on their phones. And so he's like, so clearly just the having the D-pad doesn't make sense. Which, he goes, brings one final company to compare Nintendo to, and you'll love this. RIM. He goes, the same arguments about physical buttons, the same loyal fan base, the same sales aren't in yet in steep decline, he goes, even though they are, they're getting there. He goes, BlackBerry's share grew significantly between 2007 and 2009, and they all felt fine. He goes, the problem, though, was that they weren't going to where the puck was going to be. They were at where it was. And he says, and in 2008, their share peaked, and it's all kind of been downhill since then. He goes, Nintendo has already reached that point where their current generation handheld isn't performing as well as the previous one. And he's like, are you going to be more like Disney, or are you going to be more like BlackBerry?
And for the longest time, the handheld was all that mattered for I mean, that was what kept, you know, Nintendo afloat. I mean, that was the rock that the company was built on. The console, sometimes it was either meteoric or it was, you know, disappointing, but that's not why the company survived or was going to falter. It was its rock has been the Game Boy since the Game Boy's been launched. And you know, that's dangerous. And it's funny, you know, we talked about this, how many years ago when that? It's 2007 when the apps were first launched in 2008. You know, I argued, and I've been arguing ever since, that, you know, at the time, Sony with the PSP, they said, we don't compete with Apple. It's a completely different product category, so we're not worried about them. And my statement was, if I'm going to spend $200 on an iPhone for games instead of a PSP for games, it doesn't really matter if it's a different category of device. You're competing for my dollars with this other device. Like, that's just how it is.
To which you were saying, you know, for a lot of people like our age, the reason why we like Nintendo is because of nostalgia reasons. But if you critically assess the hardware and, you know, and the graphics and all that stuff, which, you know, kids do because they don't have the history, like, it's not as good.
And I mean, you know, I like it for the nostalgia and the games that I want to play, but ultimately that's one of the big reasons why I sit there and go, what else am I going to be able to do with it? I can't justify it. It's not going to evolve with me. Whereas my iPhone evolves with me. If I get tired of a certain type of game or a certain type of productivity or if I get a different job or whatever, the iPhone's going to evolve with me with new apps. But, you know, and I sit there and I go, you know, unfortunately, I hate to do this to Nintendo, but, you know, the same rule that applied to Sony and the PSP, which has just devastated PSP sales, applies to Nintendo just the same. You compete with the iPhone. And they're kicking your butt. They're crushing you. And like you said, and like John said, for the same reason that they crushed BlackBerry. And it's the same thing that I've been saying since the launch of the iPhone. Give the digital keyboard some time. You'll get used to it. It may not, and it may never be as good, but you'll get used to it. And the thing is, and what Apple did was they built a keyboard. They built predictive typing. That was the key. That's what makes digital keyboards work, because they're awful compared to a physical keyboard, because you hit wrong buttons all the time, but now it doesn't matter what buttons you hit. And, you know, the thing is that, you know, with video games it's a little bit different. You can't do that same thing, but there will be a solution. And I personally think, you know, with the new iOS, they're clearly going in the direction of they want to be able to make it easy for third-party hardware people to make gamepads for the iPhone for iOS, and nobody knows specifically what the long-term strategy is on that. Is that all there is to it? Do they have a bigger plan? Are they going to add it to the Apple TV so it becomes a console in and of itself? Blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter. The fact of the matter is they're going to open up a standard that all third-party manufacturers will be able to build devices, different sizes, different compatibility. It'll connect to your iPhone via Bluetooth, and it will work for any game that calls on those APIs. So all of a sudden, manufacturer company A can make a gamepad that's compatible with company L, you know, whereas it used to be company A would make a gamepad that was compatible with company A's games. And all of a sudden, once that happens and once people start to make games that use those APIs and hardware companies make hardware that use those APIs, you're going to have people like me are going to go out and buy shell cases or buy cases that have gamepads on them so I can play stupid games while I'm flying to England. And, you know, and then all of a sudden it's done. The game is done. There is absolutely no reason to buy a Nintendo over an iPod Touch with a gamepad. And what's Nintendo supposed to do then? You know, it's like, I don't know. I think they're, you know, at that point, all of a sudden it becomes they are just a software company and they have to look at themselves that way, without a solid platform. You know, because they can't survive on the console generations alone. Over time, that's been obvious. They need a more solid stream of income.
Yeah, I understand. I understand.
I love Nintendo. I hate to give good people bad news, as the Oracle said to Neo.
True. So,
what's next?
What do you want to talk about? I can talk about something, or you can, or.
So I'm gonna stick with material science for a little bit.
Do it.
So Samsung has announced their new 24-layer 3D NAND flash memory, or NAND. NAND is a type of logic gate that allows you to build steady non-volatile memory, aka memory that doesn't need a power source or, you know, flash drives. And it's kind of cool. It's 128 gigabyte flash hard drive.
It's pretty big, right?
That is pretty big, but the thing is that it's like they've already got like 128 gig one out there that's a single layer. And so everybody's like, what's the big deal about this? And I like this article because it actually lays out what the potential of 3D or of 3D chips are. So the thing is that they talked about their you know, so in order to really understand the potential of 3D chips, you need to understand first the potential of, or you need to understand what's going on with your 1D or 2D okay. chips, I should say. So essentially 2D chips is you put all your circuitry on one flat plane.
Got it.
And in order to fit more and more transistors into a smaller and smaller, you know, onto a chip, you have to make them smaller and smaller.
Or make the area bigger.
What?
Or make the area bigger.
Exactly. But they can't do that because it's got to fit in a certain... That's not the goal, James. So they're trying to make it smaller and smaller. And so
I'm thinking outside the chip.
Yeah, there we go. Jeez, that's terrible. I think that might be the title of our podcast, Thinking Outside the Chip. And so with the two, essentially in order to build 128-gig 2D NAND flash chip, they had to get down to 1 nanometer technology, which is transistors, which is tiny. It's incredibly small. It's cool that they can do it that way. It requires incredible precision. And as somebody who builds tools that help build these things, that's really hard. It's really expensive. You have to build these incredibly precise lithographic tools and incredibly precise doping systems because everything's so small. You get off by nothing, a few molecules off, and you've totally blown the transistor. So they're incredibly precise, they're incredibly expensive, and they require big-time retooling in order to get this stuff out there, which makes the chips really expensive, because the raw materials always cost the same. So what makes chips expensive is paying off the capital investment of the equipment. Okay. That is the expensive part about any new technology in the semiconductor industry, because they all use the same chemicals, they all use the same base product as the generation before them. So basically what they do with these 3D layer ones is you make a wafer and you do all your lithography, all your doping and everything, and you build a chip up, and then you sandwich another chip on top of it. And you do that with quite a few layers of them, and they've been able to get up to 24 layers, which allows them to build these 128-gig chips, which is exciting. And the reason why it's exciting is this. Essentially, this article walks through, and he kind of does makes some very conservative assumptions, does a little quick math, and he essentially comes to the conclusion that in order to get the same number of transistors, because it runs on the same technology, the NAND versus NAND, you can assume that it requires about the same number of transistors. So essentially what it allows you to do is allows you to make the chip bigger because you're going up in three dimensions as opposed to two, like you said earlier. And what's cool about this specifically is that because you can do it with the bigger transistors, you can go up to maybe go back up to your 5-nanometer or even your 10-nanometer processes. They require a lot less precision, and they require old technology. So the foundation of what you're doing is being done on old tools. Tools that this is not super exciting news for me, as is what I do is sell new tools. But it's exciting for me in that I buy flash memory. So what it does is it allows them.
Yeah, but these wouldn't fit in existing sockets, would they?
No, they totally would.
Huh.
They're very thin. They would totally fit in, or that's the goal, is to fit them into existing. Because you might have problems with that. But the goal is to build like thumb drives that work on the same the same size. Okay. And I don't know if you've ever like held a raw silicon wafer. They're super thin. They're crazy thin. Cut you thin. So what's cool about this is now all of a sudden they're saying all of those old tools that we have, and by old tools I mean, 4 or 5 year old tools that are essentially good tools or just need to be refurbished, they can leverage those way further. And they've already got a huge army of tool. They've got all these fabs built up. Now they can continue to use those. That'll drive the price down like crazy. And so all they have to do is really perfect is the alignment process, which is still expensive and difficult. But that's way less expensive than building up 1-nanometer fabs. So this is pretty exciting in that.
Well, and you take that eventually to the logical conclusion of. eventually it will make its way to the 1 nanometer fabs.
Exactly. And this is all part of the march to get to keep Moore's Law progressing, which really and truly, Moore's Law started out as a, you can double the, every 18 months you double the number of transistors you can fit on a wafer, which is very cool and is held basically true. But, or I should say, that rule hasn't necessarily held true, but the halving of the cost has, because of all these other technologies and different jump ropes that they've done, and the end of Moore's Law, where you really hit the physical number, the ultimate limit of you can't make a transistor any smaller because you've run out of molecules. What's next after that? The answer is always, well, it's a different material where you start over again, but you keep the same speeds and the same performance and similar costs, and that's why graphene is so exciting. That's why diamonds are so exciting. That's why all these other new materials are so exciting, because it allows you to keep that cost crunching continuing down. And this is another one of those ones where it's like, really, really immediately you'll see the financial consequences of being able to build these. You'll see a huge drop in flash again as you get more and more fabs that get better and better at building these layered wafers, these layered chips, and that are able to, all they're doing is they're now buying $1 million worth of equipment instead of making new fabs at $10 million worth of equipment. It's a, it's cool. It's exciting. I'm excited, James.
Sounds like it.
So, it's funny. It's the first time that I've actually seen an article that really kind of walked through the product comparisons that got, now I was like, you know what? I get it now. I get why 3D is a big deal. And I've been in the industry for 2 years, we compete with these guys, and it's like the first time anybody really explained it to me in a way. I went, "Oh, that's exciting. Okay, cool." I like it.
That is cool. Another disclosure for you.
Yeah. My boss isn't gonna fire me over this, so I don't mind.
It's all right.
He doesn't listen either. Jerk.
Seriously. So here's the question.
Yes.
Who, you know how we've asked the question, who will Apple be better at becoming Google, or will Google get better at becoming Apple? That's not the exact question. But you know what I mean? And whoever can do it first kind of wins.
Yeah.
So Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah.
Doing the same little dance, same tango.
That's true.
Yeah. So, especially this last week, maybe last 2 weeks, Twitter and Facebook are definitely starting to do their thing. Like, for example, Facebook, has introduced hashtags a little while ago.
Yeah.
And now they're experimenting with trending topics being posted on the website. You know, because in a lot of ways, Twitter is where you go for breaking news, content discovery. Facebook's where you go for friend updates, essentially. And Facebook is making moves to make it more like content discovery.
Right.
The Twitter. But don't worry. Twitter this week announced that they're becoming like Facebook.
Nice.
Not in the sense that they're necessarily doing friend updates, but they just changed they change, and I just don't have the right type of friends I follow. They're changing the timeline.
Really?
To where there's this blue line now. So the idea would be let's say that you tweeted something out, and we have an imaginary third friend who's following both of us, okay? You tweet something out. Another update's come in after you, and so you start going down. I come and I see it, half hour later, whatever, and I decide to reply to you. Whoa, man, that's totally awesome. Cool beans. It takes your original post and brings it on up to the top with mine, connected via a blue line.
All right.
So what they would see would be your original tweet, then my reply, then the continuation of the stream in reverse chronological order. But your tweet and my reply, yours would look like you literally just did your tweet, half a second before mine, but because of the line, you would know that they're connected. So it's very similar to a Facebook post and then comments underneath, except, you know, comments are treated almost as if they're another post.
Right. You know? That, which totally makes sense. I mean, I use Twitter weird, but it's like, I've always been able to kind of like make the connection, but at the same time, man, anytime you can, it's a huge UI improvement. Like, there's no reason to not do that.
Well, and they were like, and the reason why Twitter's doing it, honestly, is they've done the research and they found that a lot of people join and get pretty confused and upset about that right away. And it's like, I can't follow these conversations. Like, all right. We're going to make it easier for you, for new people to come on board and do things like that. They've also, as you've seen, you can expand tweets. You know, if it's a news article, it gives you a little snippet with a photo. You can see the retweets. You know, you've seen that with the photos and the videos, which, again, is like exactly the way Facebook does their thing, right? You type in a URL into your status bar and, you know, a little whatever preview, little card shows up. And so Facebook's been doing, or Twitter's been doing that for a while. But man, it's like they're slowly but surely coming together.
Yeah.
To match each other. The only difference being Facebook doesn't require, well, yeah. No, not even more, because you can subscribe. But, you know, Facebook is predicated on it's your real name, essentially. And
right.
Ideally, you friend each other so a conversation happens, though that's not required. Whereas Twitter is still about, you know, handles, which if you're like you and me, you use your real name anyway, so that's the difference. But it's not a requirement, right? But yeah, I just think it's super interesting. So I guess the question is, do you think Facebook will ever be able to... I don't think Twitter will ever become Facebook. I just don't see that happening. But do you think Facebook will ever be able to replace Twitter?
No.
No. Interesting.
And the reason why...
Because I don't know if I agree with you, but you could probably convince me.
The reason why has nothing to do with the technology. I don't think... I think that Facebook could copy the code that is Twitter and have an identical one that runs faster and better. They got better engineers. They got better servers.
Well, they've never done that before. I don't...
Well, but I mean... But what I think... What I'm saying is... I'm saying...
They do that all the time.
What?
They do that all the time.
Right, exactly. Well, yeah, exactly. But what I'm saying is... And they wouldn't win. And the reason is because it's a different community. It's a different purpose. People think of it as a different tool with a different goal. And it has to do with the fact that you have a handle, not a name. You know, and that I don't know, subtle differences like that really create these cultural differences that allow different platforms to survive. You know, and it's and others, some to thrive, and sometimes cultural changes are impossible to really like nail down. You know, I think that if Twitter ends up not surviving and wins and Facebook beats them out or vice versa, it'll have very little to do with, or it'll be difficult to really tack down which one made the right step at the right moment. Or it'll be like they'll be blindsided by some other third competitor that'll come in and wipe
them out.
Yeah,
yes.
But it's like one of the things that was interesting this week, I read a couple articles on, was it's the anniversary of DigV4. This last week was, which actually makes sense because I became a user of Reddit on your birthday. And it sounds about right. It sounds like, and I still can't figure out what was going on that day that I decided to join that day, but that's what my membership date is. But it makes sense. It was about, I stuck with Dig for about two months, but what's really fascinating is if you see usage trends and Google trends, and they were showing all these different trends. You know, everybody always talk about the great Dig exodus, where everybody left Dig and went to Reddit. But the thing is if you actually look at the data...
And I still remember that XKCD comic about the lifeboats.
Exactly. But what's really fascinating is if you look at the actual trends over time, and from a number of different sites, what you realize is that Reddit was growing and Dig was falling. And there was a distinct bump in both sites about that time. Huh. But they both normalized pretty soon after that, and continued on the same trend as though it never happened, where Dig kept going down and Reddit kept going up, which I think is fascinating. Because the reason I say all that is because you think of these things as like being driven, or we like, you know, it's kind of like the stock market. We like to be able to assign blame, but sometimes stuff just happens, and it's a culture. And they're very difficult to. It's Dig was changing in a way people didn't like, and Dig V4 was a big Hail Mary. They were trying to change to become something that people would like, and it didn't work, but it was already not working, whereas Reddit, for whatever reason, was working, and it just sticks in people's mind as the event, but the reality of it was it wasn't nearly as big a deal as everybody like thinks of it. And so I say that to get to the point of I don't think Twitter's in risk of being shut down because Facebook becomes better at doing what Twitter does. If they are at risk, it's from the internal struggle of their own community. They thrive and survive on the merits of their community and what the community does. And what the community treats it as is a news feed of, you know, breaking news, you know, and it's not, and it probably is because it was like the first tools that allowed you to do that, but as people came expecting that, that's the culture of it, that's the kind of news people put on it, and that's just what it's become. It's like Vine, everybody thought was going to be this sharing little videos. Turns out it's an entertainment thing. Comedians love it and go crazy with it, and they've got all the followers, and it's not Jimmy Fallon sharing little clips of his life like he would on Twitter. It's comedians doing comedy in 6 seconds or less, whereas people sharing little videos of their life, that's all Instagram. Instagram's completely taken over that. Whereas Vine is thriving in this media creation world. It's the same product. They do the same things, but they're thriving because of different communities.
Okay.
I don't know. So that's kind of where my... What were you going to say?
Oh, I was just going to say, I could definitely see where Facebook keeps pushing in over time. Because, I mean, I share news articles and stuff on Facebook. And as they start to make some of the more global trends more visible, I guess, to people, I could see where, you know, you find yourself on Facebook checking out your friends and you go, oh, wow, check this out. There's, you know, a news story about Syria or a speech that the president made about Syria, to use some relevant recent news. You could start to see that stuff, and so you go, oh, cool, I've got it here. And in some ways, it's personalized towards you because they know what other articles you tend to click on and tend to like. And, you know, so it's this blend of, hey, we think you'd be interested in this, but we also know this is trending, so we really think you'd be interested in this. I don't know. I just think they could do a lot they could do a good job of doing a filter for you, where Twitter's not great at that. Though I would love to see that, though, and I think either one could do it, where, you know, Twitter's like, you know, we notice you tend to do links about this, or, you know, posts about this topic. Here's things that are trending that we think you would be interested in, which is, you know, Dig V4, I guess, but,
right.
There you go. But I just think that Facebook, they've got the users, they have the content, they just need to figure out a way to surface it, especially for news junkies. Let that, you know, really let that come flying in. I think there's a way for them to do that. But and mostly because they got the users, and it's more than just a feed, you know. But and they do seem to be becoming very similar. But I could see where you're talking about, where there are different communities, and Twitter definitely has a fit for it. But it would be interesting to see if Twitter does, similar to Vine, becomes specialized in news type stuff, and individuals don't ever actually use it, similar to Instagram. You know, you do your updates, you're sharing. You know, Facebook doesn't necessarily share. It shares news, but it's not like late breaking. We need a lot of it. It's just, oh, we think you'd find this news interesting. But
right.
P.S. I hate to admit it, but Facebook sponsored posts on my iPhone, they're not bad. I find myself clicking on them every once in a while, and then I'm like, ah, stop that. Don't do that. I know it's sponsored. I'm like, ah, I don't stop. But it's interesting. I'm like, dang it, they got me.
That's funny.
Which I guess is good, right? Because if it's working and I'd like them to stay around, I don't mind that company paying. If they did a good job, I guess I'll reward them.
Yeah.
I'm making them pay. But I'm still, I have like this, just, like, no, I shouldn't be clicking on that because it's an ad.
Right, yeah.
But that's the weird part, too. I'm like, I don't feel like I'm getting sold anything. It's genuinely interesting. But, which I guess is the holy grail for ad type stuff. So, by the way, you did bring up Dig, and they are now owned by Betaworks. And Betaworks also recently updated Instapaper to a very similar look and feel of their new Dig tool.
Yeah.
So you should check it out.
All right. I will.
Your turn.
All right. All righty, righty, right. There's something I wanted to talk about.
Well, you're figuring that out. I also highly recommend that you go and watch this video with Kevin Spacey, where...
Yeah, let's talk about that one.
It's pretty cool. Here, hopefully this will start playing. The previous page is sending you to that. All right, yeah. Send me there, whatever. He's talking about his experience with House of Cards and Netflix, and it's good, and it's only 5 minutes long. We'll give you a little preview of him speaking.
Is he speaking? I can't hear anything. It's not making it into the...
What?
It's not making it into Google Voice at all. Not even kind
what?
Of.
Really? So maybe that sound earlier, we were just standing there in silence. Oh, I know why. Dang. So that's interesting. If you couldn't hear it playing earlier, but yet you timed it right.
You know what it was? I probably heard it coming out of your headphones. Your speakers were so loud that I could hear it through the mic. Because I can sometimes hear myself echoing through your headphones.
Huh. That's interesting. I think I had one of my settings wrong. So, well, whatever. We sat there. Let's try this one more time.
Okay.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Did you hear that little...
The relief for all of you is that I am not someone with an important job in broadcasting using this speech to audition for an even more important job in broadcasting. House of Cards, creatively, actually follows the model more often employed here in Great Britain. The television industry here has never really embraced the pilot season looked to by the networks in the United States as a worthwhile effort. And now look, of course, we went out to all the major networks with House of Cards, and every single one was interested in the idea, but every single one wanted us to do
it. I love the way he talks.
Yeah.
And it wasn't out of arrogance that David Fincher and Bo Willem and I were not interested in having to audition the idea. It was that we wanted to start to tell a story that would take a long time to tell. Mm. We were creating a sophisticated, multi-layered story with complex characters who would reveal themselves over time and relationships that would need space to play out. And the obligation, of course, of doing a pilot from the writing perspective is that you have to spend about 45 minutes establishing all the characters and create arbitrary cliffhangers and basically generally prove that what you're setting out to do is going to work.
If he ever decided to do audiobooks, I think I'd be in.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know. It's a fascinating little talk because he basically gets into why the Netflix model makes more sense than everything else.
Yeah, which I think that little part that he just said there, you know, kind of spells it out. He goes, it gives us an opportunity to tell a long story. We're not dependent on cliffhangers. We're not dependent on cycles. You know, and
yeah, well, it gets away from the, you know, the syndicated television show, which is really like the essence of American TV when you talk about, you know, the popcorn popping, you know, plug in and disconnect your brain. Whereas he's talking about making actual art. And the thing is that Netflix obviously is great if you just want to, you know, unplug your brain, because it gives you that same, like, you know, binging, unplugging feeling while, you know, also allowing people to express different formats. I mean, we talked about this before. It just gives people more creativity, more, you know, flexibility.
Yeah.
You don't have to make a 23 and a half minute long episode with breaks at, you know, 14 minutes and or, you know, at 8 minutes and 14 minutes. I mean, it's I don't know. It just makes way more sense to me, and you know, in that it gives more flexibility. And he brings up what's the difference between a movie? Is it that it's a fundamentally different form? No, it's just that it's a length thing. And he talks about the blurring of that line and how that goes away. He also talks about how, you know, if you make the content available when people want it at prices people are willing to pay, you can still make a lot of money doing it. Which is, you know, obviously true. And it's just one of those things where it's like, man, he's basically just like keys up why the, you know, the Netflix app channel idea makes way more sense than cable bundle TV. And he even gets into the difference between, you know, like what happened to the audio industry or, you know, to the music industry. And I don't know. It's a good video to watch, and he basically just what's most exciting about it is it's a lot of what you'll hear on this show. It's a lot of what you'll hear from a lot of different people, but the key to it is that you're hearing it from somebody who's hugely successful financially and professionally in the field, talking to people in the field, saying, "Hey guys, maybe we should get on get on this bandwagon because it's gonna pull out of the station without us if we don't."
And, or without you, because he's on it.
Yeah, exactly. And
I'm
going to make a
bunch. By the way, makes me want to go watch House of Cards yet again.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm like, man, just sounds intriguing.
Yeah.
But yeah, no. So anyways, it's only 5 minutes. We'll link it up. It'll have his name in the title. So check it out.
Cool. The other thing I wanted to kind of mention is I got to do this thing a while back. Man, it was one of the first things I talked about on this show. It was early on the show. I got to go to a silent disco, which was pretty cool. It was a DJ who was like...
I remember that.
He was doing his thing on stage, and all of his sound equipment was plugged into an FM short-range transmitter, and then everybody had headphones on that were FM receivers. And we were all listening to music together, but you take your headphones off, and it was silent. You put your headphones on, it was like bumping club music, and it was out in the outdoors. It was super cool. And I always thought it was really awesome and wanted to do it again and wish it had happened more. Well, Apple's going to allow it to happen. They filed a patent. They're going to probably be moving it into iOS at some point soon. The ability to basically broadcast short range, you know, near field stuff where one person is the broadcaster and you get a bunch of receivers. And everybody uses their iPhone or their iPod touches as their receiver. Just plug in your normal headphones and boom, silent disco. Which all of a sudden I sit there and I go, I'll bet you could make an app for that. And now it really upsets me that I thought that was a cool idea 2 years ago and never even crossed my mind. I bet you could make an app for that. So this is why I'm not super rich. Because once in a while I have great ideas and just doesn't even, you know, whatever.
But now you got a Mac. Next time you're like, that sounds like a cool idea. Be like, I should try to program that up.
Exactly. So.
That's funny. That's cool. There you go. Yeah. Might happen more often now.
So.
You can enjoy that.
Yep.
Speaking of missing things. It was just like a few weeks back. Do you remember me talking about how I had to download the video for this, and it was like super big because it was HD?
Yeah.
Yeah, it turns out that wasn't official until like this week. So Google Plus Hangouts is going HD. we had news and we didn't even know it.
That's awesome. That's funny, man. Wow.
Yeah,
so. You're here to hear fierce people. That's what we're good at.
Yeah,
the news before the news. We are prophets of sorts. We are soothsayers.
Anything else you want to chat about?
I don't know. Vodafone's trying to sell their stake in Verizon, which seems like it should be interesting, but it's not really interesting yet because it's like.
Hasn't happened.
Yeah, it hasn't happened, and there's it's Verizon's still big. It's just sort of like, and then the other one is that Hugo Barra departed from Android. This one's a little bit interesting, but nobody really knows what it means. Hugo Barra is the dude that took over for is the second guy in charge. So the first guy in Android team. He was there for a while, kind of allowed it to get to where it was. Earlier this year, Hugo Barra took over, and they did a bunch of shuffling of the chairs and putting different people in different departments, basically setting up like this department handcrafted for Hugo Barra, and he decided to leave Google this last week, and he's heading to a Chinese company It's like, ooh, okay, I guess. So now Android is a rudderless ship at this point. Probably, not really. But I'm going to say, it's interesting, you know, it'll be interesting to see who comes next. Once again, it's like, it's interesting in that things are changing, but until you know who takes over, it's more of a, things are a little bit up in the air for now, you know.
Yeah, probably super exciting for the people who work there, because they're like, who's going to be it? What are we doing? But for the rest of the world, you're like, won't even notice.
Yeah. So
it'll distract them from getting work done for a couple of days.
It's true.
And if you're not getting better, you're getting worse.
Right.
Because your competition's getting better each day.
Yeah.
At least that's what my football coach always told me.
Yeah. I remember talks like that. It's, the other thing is that, I guess I'll throw this in really at the last minute. Nexus 4 dropped their phone price, $100. Pretty exciting if you want a Nexus 4 for $100 less. But more importantly, it probably indicates the
4S.
Well, yeah. The
4X, perhaps?
The incipient, in the imminent arrival of the next.
Go with imminent.
Yeah, but there's another word I wanted to.
Imminent?
No. I like that word, but it's.
Soon to be.
Yeah.
Upcoming. On the precipice.
The incipient. Incipient was the word I was looking for, but it's actually the wrong word, because incipient is in the initial stages, beginning to happen or develop. So. I think the imminent
is the initial stages. First, yeah, you're right. Price
cut. You're right. This is the incipient stages, or the incipient moment of the next generation of the Nexus 4, which is exciting. And this also...
maybe they'll release it in 2 weeks.
Oh, baby, that'd be super exciting. I doubt it. That'd be stupid to do that.
I don't know. Like, Samsung.
Toe-to-toe with Samsung.
I know. We'll release something a week before.
Yeah,
we'll do it. No big deal.
Go toe to toe with Samsung and Apple. That'd be terrible. For them, it just would be embarrassing, because nobody would be like, "That's a stupid phone. Nobody buys that." And like, but it's cheap and affordable and awesome. And they'd be like, "It doesn't matter. Go away."
Maybe. Plus, they just did the Moto X. You know.
Exactly.
Put them all together. Spread it out a little bit.
Exactly. On the same thing, Apple has begun their trade-in program for iPhones. Bring your own iPhone, they'll give you less money than anybody else.
So they're also on the incipient?
Yeah, incipient.
Incipient of the next iPhone?
Yeah. So,
it's begun. We're in September. That's what it is.
I know. Exactly.
That's
September
what this means.
September 1st. Here. It's awesome. It's awesome. Awesome. It's a great time for...
Good first month.
Exactly.
Just half of the month.
So,
that's something exciting to talk about for the next 2 weeks minimum.
Yeah, that's true.
We really struggle to come up with topics.
I know. You know, it's nice. I'm glad to hear that we're going to get to episode 104, because that's our 2-year anniversary.
It's good to know. And we'll talk about nothing but Apple, which is probably pretty close to what our first episode was.
You know what? Because our first, If you go all the way back in the records, our pilot episode,
which I don't think you can, because I don't know if I actually published the pilot episode.
Oh, you didn't? Oh man, you should almost do that just for the fun of it.
I don't know.
Because the pilot episode we did, we didn't do it on Sunday. We talked about doing it on Sunday, but we didn't, because we wanted to get in our predictions right before the big iPhone announcement, that was our first, which literally nobody listened to, so I'm not even sure why we thought that was so important, other than it was just fun to talk about. And then our next episode was us talking about the Apple announcement. We haven't changed a lot.
Well, you know, it's a formula that works, right?
Exactly.
This is actually really hard. I should take a bet that there's like 16 pages Let's see. Well, let me go back that far. Oh my gosh, that only gets me to 72. All right, fine. Let's see, let's go 30 pages back. Ooh, too far. Okay, so we got a bounds here. Let's just try 25 pages.
Yeah, I was going to say, because at some point
ooh,
we signed...
If I had $1 billion, I'm not doing numbers anymore. So that's far enough back. All right, we're getting there, we're getting there. Ooh, yeah, remember this one? Am I Big Data or am I a Muppet? Oh, there it is. Oh, no, the pilot show is available on page 26.
Nice.
I was close. It was October 3rd, 2011 is when I posted it.
I was going to say.
We did a few weeks where we didn't have a website. We were just kind of doing it and sharing it internally, if you will, to friends and family.
I'm gonna say, are we Big Data or are we? I can't believe that was 2 years ago that we did that. Time.
Yeah, so we did. Let's see here, the Furlough Bros podcast 01 pilot show.
Yeah.
And we had Are You Serious? and then we had Data Mind Your Own Business. I love this stuff. Yeah. NFC near future communication. Follow us at Rich and Famous Bros. And Furlough Bros is live. Oh, that wasn't actually a show. That was just a...
Yeah, that's funny. You know what? The Muppets came out in November 2011, and we started the show October 2011. So...
There you go.
Yeah, makes sense.
Then we had Touching the Future, Unless You're Rim. Then we had a Transition, which I like that one. And then Tis the Season for Commercialism. It's all on the first page. Am I Big Data or Am I Muppet? That was the first set right there.
And I feel like that was the first episode where we really decided
we're
going to talk about movies occasionally in this. Movies are going to be part of this. We didn't even talk about it. We've never talked about it. This is the first time we've ever actually talked about it. But I think that was the first time where it was just like, yeah, that's going to be part of the show. We talk about movies occasionally. Get over it. When the Muppets movie. That's funny. Good just lord.
Yeah, it's good. So, yeah, we'll make it. I like that idea of doing a throwback or a callback. We'll just take the week off and just repost that.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be great. That was back when we were doing it, recording locally on our own machines, and then I was splicing it all together to make it work. Yes.
That is so funny.
Days? That was so much work, so hard. Now Google Hangouts HD make it so easy.
That's so funny. I'm gonna say I would let you just repost that episode if it were possible for me to spend that particular week not talking about what was going on in the tech industry. But it's like everybody's gonna have all these new products. We're gonna have a bunch of impending products, things in their incipient stages. And and it's just gonna be like the whole reason we started this podcast so I could talk about it. Like you can't not let me talk about it.
Yeah. No, I understand. I'll figure out a way to make it work.
All right.
I'll just just do another post. Redo. So anyways, that's our show. That's our show.
As you have to say.
We were everywhere this week. So thank you, everybody, for joining us. One of the, I will say, longest running tech podcasts on the net. Because why not?
We're top 1,000.
Yeah. Which, we're up there. We're just one of many. So anyways, my name is James Furlough. My laboring brother is Matthew Furlough. So we will talk next time. I was typing. We got
Oh man, that is perfect. That is perfect.
All of a sudden it showed up. We think you're typing. Stop.
Oh, jeez.